Welcome back to Automate Office Work. I'm your host, Justin, and today we're tackling something that touches every single person who has ever worked in an office, run a business, or signed anything on a dotted line, digital or otherwise. We're talking about signatures and authentication. And the question that almost nobody asks clearly enough, what are we actually trying to accomplish here? Now, I know what some of you are thinking. Signatures? Isn't that just DocuSign? And that's exactly the problem. Because the answer is sometimes, but not always. And getting it wrong in either direction costs you real money, real legal exposure, and real friction with your customers and your team. Let me start with a piece of history, because I think it reframes the whole conversation. For most of recorded human civilization, the primary technology for authenticating a document was a wax seal pressed with a signet ring. If you've ever watched a period drama where a king sends a letter and his secretary drips hot wax onto the envelope and presses a ring into it, that's it. That's the entire authentication infrastructure of medieval Europe. The idea was simple. Only the king has the ring. So only the king could have sealed this letter. And it worked. Right up until it didn't. Because signet rings could be stolen. Wax could be reheated and repressed. Forgers existed, then just as they do now. The technology of trust has always been in an arms race with the technology of fraud. Fast forward to today, and we have cryptographic digital signatures that can mathematically prove, not just assert, but prove that a specific person signed a specific document at a specific moment in time, and that not a single bit of that document has been altered since. That's a genuinely extraordinary leap. And yet, plenty of organizations are still emailing PDF attachments back and forth and asking people to print, sign, scan, and return, which, if you think about it, is barely a step above the wax seal. So why does this gap exist? It comes down to three forces that are almost always in tension with each other. The first is security, the desire to prevent fraud, impersonation, and document tampering. The second is convenience, the need for a process that people will actually use without abandoning it halfway through or calling your support desk. And the third is legal enforceability, the requirement that if this ever ends up in front of a judge, you can prove what was agreed to and by whom. Here's the critical insight that drives everything we're going to talk about today. These three forces don't always point in the same direction. The most secure method is often the least convenient. The most convenient method might not hold up in court, and the legally required method for a specific document type might be frustratingly old-fashioned. The goal of this episode is to give you a framework, not a one-size-fits-all rule, for selecting the right tool based on the specific risk profile of each type of transaction in your business, because the right answer for signing an internal expense approval is very different from the right answer for signing a real estate deed. And if you're treating them the same way, you're either over-engineering simple things or under-protecting complex ones. This podcast is available on all the major platforms, live every Friday on LinkedIn, and then available on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. No matter where you're getting this content, could I ask you to tickle the algorithm and like, subscribe, comment, and share to help us grow and help more people? It's greatly appreciated. Just search for Automate Office Work or go to automateofficework.com, and there's a podcast section showing you our 80-plus episodes and links to all the platforms. Now back to the episode. Let's start with the most important thing most people don't know about signatures, the legal definition. A signature is not a handwriting sample. It's not a stylized scrawl of your name. It is not even ink on paper, necessarily. A signature, at its legal core, is simply evidence of intent. The law is interested in one question. Did this person knowingly agree to this thing? Everything else, the pen, the paper, the font, the format, is just supporting evidence for the answer to that question. This is why a simple I agree checkbox can be legally binding. It's why a typed name at the bottom of an email has been upheld as a signature in certain contexts. And it's why the format of your signature matters far less than the context in which it was given. Now, here's a thought experiment that really illustrates how fragile the concept of a signature actually is. Imagine two people shake hands on a business deal. One says, "I'll supply you with 5,000 units at $12,000 each, delivery in 30 days. The other says, "Deal." They shake hands. Is that a contract? In principle, absolutely. An oral agreement with a clear offer and a clear acceptance, witnessed by both parties, that's a contract. People have been legally bound by handshakes for as long as handshakes have existed. But what happens when one party changes their mind and the other sues? You end up in a he said, she said situation with zero documentary evidence. No paper trail, no timestamp, no witness beyond the two parties themselves, who now have opposite accounts of what was agreed. The contract may well be valid, but proving it is another matter entirely. Now, watch what changes if 30 seconds after that handshake, one party sends an email that says, "Great to finalize our deal today. As agreed, 5,000 units at $12 each, delivery by the 15th. Let me know if you have any questions." And the other person replies with, "Confirmed. Thanks." The email exchange doesn't replace the contract. The handshake was already the contract. What the email does is create a contemporaneous written record that corroborates the terms of the oral agreement. Suddenly that he said, she said problem becomes a he said, here's the email confirming what he said situation. The strength of the evidence has shifted dramatically without a single formal signature being involved. This is a principle I'd encourage you to build into your workflows, even when you're using formal signature processes. The paper trail around the signature often matters as much as the signature itself. The email exchanges, the version history of the document, the audit logs, all of that context strengthens the evidentiary value of whatever agreement you're documenting. If you've made it this far, you're probably getting benefit from what I have to share. You might even be thinking about sharing this with colleagues or having a conversation with your team. If you're feeling generous and would like to give back to support me in my efforts, you can do so at buymeacoffee.com/automateoffice. Donations can be one-time or recurring in any amount that you would like, and show me that you appreciate the content I provide. Now let's talk about the actual tools. There are three broad categories, and they exist on a spectrum of security versus convenience. First is simple e-signatures. This is the broadest category. An e-signature, the general sense, is any electronic representation of a person's agreement. A pasted image of your handwritten signature, an I agree checkbox at the bottom of a terms of service page, typing your name into a field in a web form, drawing your signature with a mouse or finger. These are low friction, easy to implement, and legally sufficient in many contexts, but forensically, they're weak. If someone later disputes their signature, there's often limited evidence beyond the signature itself. You can't necessarily prove that the person who owns that email address was the one who clicked the button, or that the image of the signature wasn't copied from somewhere else. Second, digital signatures, the cryptographic kind. This is what platforms like DocuSign, Adobe Sign, and their equivalents actually provide. The name is confusingly similar to e-signature, but the underlying technology is fundamentally different. A true digital signature uses public key cryptography to create a mathematical binding between the signer's identity and the document content. When you sign a document through one of these platforms, several things happen simultaneously. A cryptographic hash, essentially a unique fingerprint of the document, is generated. That hash is encrypted with the signer's private key, and a bundle of metadata is captured. The IP address, the timestamp, the email address used, the browser and device information, and often a full audit trail of every time the document was opened, clicked, and signed. The result is that any subsequent alteration of the document would break the cryptographic signature. It would be mathematically detectable, and the audit trail creates a strong chain of evidence that a specific person authenticated through their email box interacted with the document. These platforms also frequently comply with standards like EIDAS in Europe or the eSign Act in the United States, which gives them explicit legal standing in their respective jurisdictions. Third, wet ink signatures. This is the original, physical pen on physical paper. And despite everything I've said about cryptography being superior, wet ink is still legally required in a number of specific contexts. Real estate transactions in many jurisdictions, certain government regulatory filings, family law documents like wills, powers of attorney, and adoption papers, high-value financial instruments. These requirements exist either because the law hasn't caught up with technology or because legislators made a deliberate decision that the gravity of those transactions warranted the friction of a physical process. There are also cases where wet ink is not legally required, but strategically valuable, which we'll come back to. The contextual matrix, matching the tools to the risk. So how do you decide which of these three to use? I want to give you a simple three-tier framework. Low-risk transactions, internal approvals, standard terms of service, routine workflow sign-offs. They don't warrant friction. A click to accept, an email confirmation, or an internal system approval with an audit log is entirely sufficient. Forcing someone to go through a DocuSign process to approve a meeting agenda is security theater. It annoys people without adding meaningful protection. Medium risk transactions, commercial contracts with external vendors or customers, employment offer letters, NDAs, service agreements, are where dedicated digital signature platforms genuinely earn their keep. The cryptographic audit trail and the institutional legitimacy of the platform both serve you well. You have something to point to if a dispute arises, and the process itself signals professionalism. High-risk transactions, real estate, financial instruments above a material threshold, regulatory filings, powers of attorney should involve wet ink, and in many cases, notarization. This is where you do not try to optimize for convenience. The extra friction is appropriate, and in many cases, the law mandates it. The key takeaway here is that the goal is not to standardize on one method. The goal is to build a repertoire and use each tool for the right job. On Automate Office Work, we talk a lot about a hard truth. You cannot solve a problem you haven't actually defined. Too many people run out and buy shiny new software or a trendy AI tool before they even know what's broken. They're just treating surface-level symptoms. But when you deeply understand your root problem, you automatically define what success looks like, and the right solution practically chooses itself. There is so much nuance to this that we just can't fit it all into a weekly podcast. That's why I built an online learning platform, Automate Office Work Academy, and created the course, Start with the Problem. This is a comprehensive 10-hour masterclass designed to turn you into a master problem solver. We skip the generic AI hype and dive into what actually matters: the art of observation, root cause analysis, hypothesis testing, and stakeholder perspectives. Plus, you'll complete a capstone project where you apply these frameworks directly to a real problem in your current job. Right now, I'm looking for a select group of founding students. The course is completely free for the first 100 people who sign up. All I ask in return is your honest feedback so I can make it even better. Don't just chase solutions. Learn how to diagnose the problem. Go to automateofficework.com/academy right now to claim your free spot before they're gone. That's automateofficework.com/academy. And now, let's get back to the show. Authority, the human bottleneck. Knowing how to sign a document is only half the problem. The other half is knowing who is authorized to sign it. This is where most organizations quietly bleed money and create legal exposure without realizing it. Because the question of authority is governed by something called a delegation of authority matrix. And most DOA matrices are a disaster. But before we get there, let's establish the vocabulary. There are three types of authority that matter in a business context. Implied authority is the authority that a reasonable person would expect someone in a given role to have. If you send your office manager to buy printer paper, and she decides to buy a slightly more expensive brand because it's better quality, she probably had the implied authority to make that call. Even if nobody explicitly said, you can spend up to X on office supplies. A reasonable person would expect someone in that role to make that kind of judgment. Explicit authority. This is the authority that has been formally delegated by virtue of title or role. Your CFO has explicit authority to sign financial statements. Your head of procurement has explicit authority to approve vendor contracts within certain parameters. This authority typically lives in a job description, board resolutions, or the company's governance documents. Last, delegated authority, also called power of attorney in its formal legal instantiation, is authority that has been specifically, often temporarily, granted by one person to another. While I'm on sabbatical, my deputy has authority to approve contracts up to $50,000. This is authority that travels with a person rather than a role, and it's often time-bound or amount-bound. Understanding these distinctions matters because the consequences of getting them wrong are serious. A contract signed by someone without the authority to sign it may be unenforceable. An expense approved by someone who exceeded their authorization can create internal governance problems and, in a public company, potentially material weaknesses in internal controls. Why DOA matrices fail? Now, most organizations try to codify authority through a delegation of authority matrix. If you've ever worked at a company of any size, you've probably seen one. It's typically a large table with a list of transaction types on one axis, dollar thresholds on another, and a grid of check marks or role names indicating who can approve what. And in theory, this is exactly the right tool. In practice, though, DOA matrices are almost universally dysfunctional for a few predictable reasons. First, they're complex, really complex. A mature organization might have dozens of transaction categories, multiple approval tiers, and different rules for CapEx versus OpEx versus headcount versus legal commitments. The matrix becomes a document that only the person who created it can navigate confidently. Second, they're static. They live in a PDF or a SharePoint page that nobody looks at unless something has already gone wrong. They're not integrated into the workflows where approval decisions are actually being made. Third, they don't account for reality. The matrix says the VP of finance approves contracts over $50,000, but the VP of finance is on parental leave for 4 months. Who approves them now? The matrix doesn't say. So someone makes an informal decision, and suddenly you have undocumented exceptions piling up. The signature manager model. Here's a practical model I want to advocate for. Instead of trying to build a better matrix, consider appointing a signature manager, a human function rather than a static document. The signature manager is typically an experienced executive assistant or office manager. Their job is not to approve things themselves, but to be the institutional knowledge repository for who can approve what and to actively manage the logistics of getting the right approvals from the right people in a reasonable time frame. They know the DOA, the delegation of authority. They know when people are traveling, when there's a coverage gap, when someone has a standing delegation in place. They know that the CFO is out on Thursday, but will be reachable on her mobile for anything over $100,000. They know that the general counsel has delegated authority for certain contract types to the associate general counsel while he's on vacation. This function transforms the DOA from a static artifact into a living process. And critically, it removes the burden from employees who are not trained in governance to figure out the right approval path for every transaction they encounter. The signature manager model works best when it includes a formal training component. Legal and finance shouldn't just hand a document to this person and say, "Learn it." They should sit with them, walk through scenarios, explain the edge cases, and make sure they understand not just the rules, but the reasoning behind them. That reasoning is what enables good judgment in situations the matrix didn't anticipate. Modern authentication strategies. Modern authentication strategies. Let's move from authority to authentication. Specifically, the question of how you verify that the person agreeing to something is actually who they say they are. Leveraging single sign-on, SSO, for internal workflows. For internal systems, this problem is often already solved, and organizations just aren't taking advantage of it. If your team is already authenticated into Microsoft 365 or Google Workspace, and they're taking an action inside SharePoint or a connected tool, you already have an identity platform. The system knows who they are. The audit log records what they did. There is no meaningful security benefit to asking them to separately sign their name on an internal approval form. You can simply give them a button in the interface where they are and have them click it. They don't need to go download a document. They don't need to print it out, sign it, scan it, and upload it back. A simple button can do. The principle here is if you already have an authenticated session with an audit trail, don't manufacture additional friction. Single sign-on is your authentication infrastructure. Use its logs as your signature record for internal processes. Reserve formal signature workflows for situations that genuinely benefit from them. The email attachment problem. Now let's talk about something that almost every small and medium-sized business is doing wrong right now: collecting sensitive documents by email. You need a copy of a client's passport or driver's license for compliance purposes, or their tax ID number, or their bank account details for direct deposit. And the way it happens 90% of the time is someone sends an email saying, "Please reply with a copy of your ID," and the customer sends back an email with a photo attached. This is a serious problem for reasons that go beyond the obvious risk of interception in transit. The deeper problem is that email is a near-permanent record that it's almost impossible to truly expunge. That sensitive document now lives in the recipient's inbox, in the sender's sent folder, potentially in a company mail archive, in the recipient's email server backup, in the sender's email server backup, and in any number of intermediate servers that process the message along the way. Under GDPR in Europe, and under an increasing number of privacy laws in other jurisdictions, you have legal obligations to be able to locate and delete personal data upon request. An email attachment has just become a backup of a backup of a backup. You can delete the email in your inbox and still have that person's passport photo sitting on a mail server somewhere that your team doesn't even know about. This isn't an abstract compliance concern. Data protection regulators have issued meaningful fines for exactly this kind of careless handling of sensitive documents. The exposure is real. The secure portal model. The alternative is to collect sensitive information through a secure web portal rather than email. This doesn't have to mean building custom software. There are document collection platforms designed for exactly this purpose. The benefits are significant. Access is controlled and auditable. You know exactly who uploaded what and when. The data is stored in a system you control. not distributed across email servers you don't control. When you need to delete that data because the client relationship ended or because they exercised their right to erasure under GDPR, you can actually do it. But there's an adoption problem. If your customers have to create an account and remember a password to access your portal, a significant percentage of them won't bother. They'll call your support line instead, or they'll just send you an email, which is exactly what you're trying to move away from. The one-time password approach. The solution that balances security and usability is what I call the no account method, built around one-time passwords. Here's how it works. You send the customer a unique URL, a link specific to their request. That URL takes them to your portal. When they arrive, they're prompted to enter their email address, and they immediately receive a 4-digit or 6-digit code sent to that email address. They enter the code, and they're in. What have you accomplished with this? You've authenticated that this person has access to the email inbox associated with their account, without asking them to remember a password, without requiring them to create an account, and without placing any ongoing burden on them. This is genuinely sufficient identity verification for most business purposes. You're not claiming to have verified their government ID. You're claiming that this document was uploaded by someone with access to the email address on file for this customer. That's a meaningful and defensible assertion. It's the same principle banks use when they send you a text code to confirm a login from a new device. The second factor proves that you have physical access to the registered phone. The one-time password on email proves access to the registered inbox. Neither is perfect, but both are proportionate to the risk. I'd like to invite you to connect with me. You can find me on LinkedIn, Justin Turman, T-U-R-M-A-N, lawyer, coder, and linguist, currently living in Amsterdam. You can also send me an email at justin@automateofficework.com or go to automateofficework.com and book a call with me. I'd like to hear from you. Do you have suggestions for future shows? Perhaps you want to come on as a guest and talk about where you are in the automation journey. I offer consulting services. Design principles for automation. I want to close with some design principles that apply across everything we've talked about. Principles for building signature and authentication workflows that actually work in the real world. First, use formality as a signal, not just a security control. Here's something counterintuitive. Even when a digital signature is legally sufficient, there are cases where you might want to send a wet ink document anyway, not because the law requires it, but because the physical act of signing signals to the signer that this is serious. A commercial lease, a significant business partnership, a personal guarantee. When the stakes are high, the ritual of signing a physical document helps ensure that the person on the other side genuinely processes what they're agreeing to, rather than clicking through it like a software end-user license agreement. This isn't inefficiency. It's communication strategy. Choose the formality level that matches the gravity you want the transaction to carry. Second, design for the offline customer. Not everyone has reliable email access. Not everyone is comfortable with digital technology. If your entire signature and authentication workflow assumes that every customer is a digitally literate professional with a smartphone, you will exclude a non-trivial portion of your customer base and create compliance gaps around the ones you can't exclude. The solution isn't to maintain a fully separate paper-based process for everyone. That's expensive. The solution is to have an exception path that your team can execute efficiently. In practice, this often means maintaining a tablet in your office or enabling a field representative to capture signatures in person, feeding into the same digital system as everyone else so the audit trail is consistent. Third, build consent management that scales. This is particularly important if you're collecting consent. For marketing, for data processing, for recurring communications, rather than signatures on contracts. The challenge with consent is not just capturing it. It's being able to revoke it cleanly and prove both the grant and the revocation later. One practical approach, when you capture consent, generate and store a unique identifier for that consent event. You can issue this as a code to the customer, something like, your preference ID is 4721. If they ever want to change their preferences or withdraw consent, they can use that ID to locate their record without needing to create an account or remember a password. You have a clean audit trail that shows, on this date, this email address granted consent, and on this later date, they withdrew it. This is simple, scalable, and genuinely compliant with the spirit of modern data protection regulation. Fourth, and finally, stop defaulting to what you've always done. The handshake that nobody remembers clearly. The PDF that gets printed, signed, scanned, and emailed in a file that nobody can actually search. The wet ink signature on a document that could have been signed digitally, just because that's how it was done before. These defaults have costs in time, in friction, in legal risk, and in compliance exposure that most organizations have never bothered to calculate. The architecture of trust in your organization is not an accident. It's a choice. And whether you've made that choice consciously or not, you're living with its consequences. The good news is that the tools to do this better have never been more accessible, more affordable, or more legally robust. All right, here are my closing thoughts. Let me leave you with the mental model I want you to take away from this episode. Every time a signature or authentication event happens in your business, there's an underlying question. What are we trying to prove and to whom? Are we proving internal authorization? Use your single sign-on audit trail. Are we proving customer intent on a routine transaction? Use a simple e-signature or one-time password flow. Are we proving the party's commitments on a significant commercial relationship? Use a cryptographic digital signature platform. Are we complying with a legal requirement for a specific document type? Do what the law requires. The right answer is different in each case, and building the organizational clarity to know which answer applies in which situation, that's not bureaucracy. That's professional maturity. Thanks for listening to Automate Office Work. If this episode sparked any questions, or if you're wrestling with a specific signature or authentication challenge in your organization, reach out. I'd love to make it the basis of a future episode. And until next time, happy automating.